So it's been a couple weeks since we last met. When we last left our hero, Gabriel Syme, he had just won the election as Thursday, and he's heading off on a boat to go meet with the other officers and, of course, the president of the anarchists, a man named Sunday. And so when he gets off the boat, he finds himself at Leicester Square, which is the heart of London. Here are some pictures. Chesterton writes about the foreignness of the city. He talks of the Saracenic outlines of the Alhambra. It looks French or even Spanish. And then later he mentions the Moorish cupolas. And of course, I'm not an expert on architecture, so I don't really know what a lot of these terms mean. But in some of these pictures, you can see these interesting looking spires. I don't know if they're called. So just, there's a lot of foreign, elements that we can see here. Let's see if there are any more. And this foreignness is a theme, later on, when Syme is in, the restaurant when he's being chased by Professor de Worms, he comments that he used to think that all foreigners were kind of anarchists. He used to look at them that way. And it says, now that he had faced the real thing, he realized that these foreigners were actually much friendlier than the real, true anarchists were. So, there we are. So we meet the other officers on the Council of the 7 Days, and we see that they too are, many of them are foreigners. Sunday, of course, is this absolutely huge mountain of a man with white hair. His ears are sticking out, and Chesterton says he is absolutely fearful and terrible and awe-inspiring. He says that all the other officers look like children or dwarves in comparison with him. And actually, Syme, when he comes in, he sees all the odd officers sitting around the table, and he doesn't even notice Sunday at first because he's so big. Maybe he blended in with the structure of the hotel. But so here's just kind of a character guide for a second so we can identify each of the officers. So Monday, he's also known as the secretary. He has this awful, crooked, twisted smile. And he's very emaciated. He has dark circles under his eyes. Tuesday, his name's Gogol. You find out he's a Pole. He has this very thick foreign accent. A lot of times it's kind of hard for even me to decipher what he was saying. And he has bushy brown hair and a beard. The book says he looks almost like a Skye Terrier with all that hair. And sad eyes. Wednesday is the Marquis, and he has a black, French cut beard, but he actually is a Jew. And, the book says that all of them are dressed, of course, in this very, fine garment. But Syme realizes that the Marquis is the only one that seems to actually fit in with the clothing. It looks kind of odd on all the other officers. And Thursday, of course, is Syme. The man named Friday is Professor de Worms. He has a long gray face and a long gray beard to go with it, and he's very weak. Syme thinks that, you know, with any sort of movement, his arm or his leg might fall off. And he says he's in a general state of decay. And Saturday, Sime thinks is almost the most fearsome of the other officers besides Sunday. He's a medical doctor, Dr. Bull. And the thing is, he looks very common. He's young and clean-shaven, and there's nothing very odd about him except for the spectacles that he's wearing. They're very dark, very opaque, so you can't even see his eyes. And Sime wonders if maybe there's something wrong with his eyes. That's why he hides them from the world. So, Chapter 6, The Exposure. I wanted to read the first paragraph of the book so we can talk about some of the imagery that Chesterton is dealing with. So, the first paragraph reads, "So were the six men who had sworn to destroy the world. Again and again, Sime strove to pull together his common sense in their presence. Sometimes he saw for an instant that these notions were subjective, that he was only looking at ordinary men, one of whom was old, another nervous, another short-sighted. The sense of an unnatural symbolism always settled back on him again. Each figure seemed to be, somehow, on the borderland of things, just as their theory was on the borderland of thought. He knew that each one of these men stood at the extreme end, so to speak, of some wild road of reasoning. He could only fancy, as in some old-world fable, that if a man went westward to the end of the world, he would find something, say, a tree, that was more or less than a tree possessed by a spirit, and that if he went east to the end of the world, he would find something else that was not wholly itself, a tower, perhaps, of which the very shape was wicked. So these figures seemed to stand up, violent and unaccountable, against the ultimate horizon, visions from the verge. The ends of the earth were closing in." So it's very interesting that he says when they look to the west, they see a tree, and when they look to the east, they see a tower. Would anyone like to comment on why that's, why is a tree linked with the west and a tower linked with the east when we're thinking about culture or society?
Think of America, think of the uninhabited score on civilized regions of the world, look at the West, look at the Asian
civilizations. Right. The American frontier is symbolized by a tree, and the already established ancient cultures of the East, of the Orient. But are there any other, what do you think of when you think of a tree? What are some important trees from history? Or maybe from the Bible?
I'm gonna take a shot at this, just thinking along the lines possibly of Jim Jordan and Peter Lighthart might teach us that throughout history, the tree is God was always towards the west.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Possibly the tree could represent the cross, the wood of the cross,
mm-hmm.
towards Christ. And the tower could represent man, and where man usually is always, when they move away from God, they move to
sin. Right. Yes, and I'm actually going to get to that in a little bit. The directions, you know, seem to be very important in this imagery. Anyone else? Can anyone else think of trees?
The trees represent men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would definitely go along with what Mr. Guptill was saying about. Well, yeah, man's movement towards the west, towards the trees. But I'm looking for a specific tree. Yes, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And how about a tower? Babel, exactly. This may be a long shot, but can anyone speculate as to how the Garden of Eden is similar to the Tower of Babel? How the stories align in some way? Maybe they did.
Maybe, are you thinking possibly Man's quest for autonomy that happened in the garden that also was symbolized by the tower?
True. Very true. Yes, the autonomy and then the dispersion, I think Mrs. Marshall said, Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden to go out into the world to inhabit it. And at the same time, at the Tower of Babel, man was divided and man was dispersed into all the world. And very end of this paragraph, it says, the ends of the earth were closing in. So it's interesting that we have this imagery of man being dispersed to the ends of the world, and then all of a sudden the ends of the earth are closing in. What does the phrase the ends of the earth make you think of? Right, the Great Commission, when Christ tells man to go to the very ends of the earth, bringing the gospel. And I guess we can see that this is what happens when the gospel, when we fail as a church to bring the gospel to the ends of the earth. The reversal of that is that anarchists come from the ends of the earth and close in on us. So that is the repercussion.
What is the meaning of the that we run the square in London?
Well, right. I mean, again, the foreignness is just, maybe in, right, because foreigners are kind of linked with the anarchists. Again, a lot of the officers we see are foreign. And I mean, to anyone, any sort of foreigners seem like enemies at first because you just don't understand them, maybe. So he has that link between the foreigners and the anarchists.
See the idea that form is associated with bad or evil. But at the same time, you do see an attachment, signs of attachment to England or London. And London is associated, and England is associated with peace and order. So it isn't only that there's some London is the center of peace and war. He takes, in one place, he feels very comforted by the thought that he's in London. I think he calls it freedom.
Right. And are you saying that there seems to be a sense that maybe things aren't all they seem?
Yes.
Right. I mean, I think we definitely, that'll definitely play a part later on in the book. So, So stay tuned. And we'll, hopefully that'll come up later as we encounter some of the surprises that Chesterton has in store for us. So Syme sits down at the table with these men. He observes them. He observes the way they're dressed, the way they look, of course, and how they're eating. They have a it's a sick conversation, but it's also kind of entertaining. They're debating whether it's best to use a knife to kill the Tsar of Russia or whether it'd be best to just use dynamite. The Wednesday, the Marquis, he's been chosen to commit this assassination. And they're debating on the methods that they should use to go about it. And all of a sudden, Sunday announces to them that he has something to say to them in private. And so he brings them to a private room inside the hotel that they're at. And he reveals that there is a spy among them. And of course, Syme gets very nervous because he knows that he is the spy. And it's very entertainingly drawn out. He takes a while to reveal who it is, and so Syme's just getting more and more nervous. He has a gun in his pocket, and he puts his hand in his pocket and keeps the trigger on it just in case. And finally, Sunday reveals that that the spy is actually Gogol, the Pole, the man who is Tuesday. And Syme sinks down into his seat, and he's very relieved, also very surprised. But before we go on to chapter 7, I wanted to go back and take a look at this moral dilemma that Syme is facing. When he first arrives on the scene with the officers, he looks over the balcony and he sees that there is a policeman down, you know, patrolling the streets. And the thought occurs to him that all it would take is he could jump off the balcony and he could go tell the policeman that there were anarchists up there and, you know, and the police could just take care of it. But of course he remembers his promise to Gregory that he would not do that. And so here he is, debating in his mind what he should do. Says, then there fell upon Syme the great temptation that was to torment him for many days. In the presence of these powerful and repulsive men, who were the princes of anarchy, he had almost forgotten the frail and fanciful figure of the poet Gregory, the merest seed of anarchism. He even thought of him now with an old kindness, as if they had played together when children. But he remembered that he was still tied to Gregory by a great promise. He had promised never to do the very thing that he now felt himself almost in the act of doing. He had promised not to jump over that balcony and speak to that policeman. He took his cold hand off of a cold stone balustrade. His soul swayed in a vertigo of moral indecision. He had only to snap the thread of a rash vow made to a villainous society, and all his life could be as open and sunny as the square beneath him. He had, on the other hand, only to keep his antiquated honor and be delivered inch by inch into the power of this great enemy of mankind, whose very intellect was a torture chamber. Whenever he looked down into the square, he saw the comfortable policeman, a pillar of common sense and common order. Whenever he looked back at the breakfast table, he saw the president still quietly studying him with big, unbearable eyes. And let me ask you, do you think that this dilemma is believable? Do you think, you know, what would you do were you in Syme's shoes? So you wouldn't do anything, you just wait it out?
For the development.
Mm-hmm.
I was just looking at it and you know that. And that's cool. You may have to shoot me.
Right.
We're jumping out and telling about everything.
Right. Well, I mean, it goes on to say in the book that it never occurred to Syme that to doubt that Sunday and his officers would be able to crush him So there was a very real fear that he was facing. Does anyone else want to comment? Do these two choices seem very equal, or do they seem... Do you think you would choose one way or the other? I mean, say that it came to whether, you know, whether he was, you know, if he had said something to reveal himself and they were going to kill him. True. Right. I mean, that's what I thought. I thought, you know, if it came down to saving my life to save the lives of others by revealing the anarchists and breaking my vow, you know, and I think it, according to human logic, it makes sense to break this little promise, to commit a little sin for the sake of, not committing a greater sin. Did you want to say something?
But sometimes he doesn't know the balcony to end it quickly because he's necessarily the writer. Because that's almost like the easier out. Whereas going through and following the promise is the better path. It's harder, but the reward is greater at the end.
Right.
And sometimes that's what you kind of need to remember, is that you're put in position for a reason. That doesn't mean that the path is going to be smooth.
Right. It's important to keep... to let God be in control and to not right, because as humans we do try to take the easier path. We try to choose the path of least resistance, and it's important to keep in mind that God's ways are not the same as our ways. First Corinthians 1:23 says, "But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and folly to the Gentiles." And it's interesting, this idea that the cross is a stumbling block and folly, because although we appreciate what Christ did on the cross, if we think about it using our human logic, we'd think, well, God's all powerful. Why doesn't he just crush Satan? Why does he need to send his son to die for us when he could have done the easier thing and he could have just completely wiped out the Romans, wiped out Satan? And of course, as you were saying, the answer to that is, the more rewarding thing, or the thing that will bring him more glory, is to have Christ die for us. And also by Syme choosing to keep his word and to keep his honor instead of revealing them, he puts his trust in God. He realizes that he's not going to just rely on man's strength. He's going to let God take control of the situation.
Mm-hmm. You know, the question is self-righteousness. How important was it to hold to that promise made at all costs? And it's always an interesting contest. In the book Les Miserables, it was so beautifully themed out with the end, the cop, Giardot, or whoever you want
to call
it. It said, "All my life, but it was the epitome of evilness."
But
it's the theme of self-righteousness versus higher righteousness. Sometimes we have to lie to the glory of God.
Right. And Javert was definitely following man's law rather than God's law. Alright, let's see. So, really quickly, I just want to go over, this is a very interesting part. We see that the diets of the officers, what and how they eat, kind of line up with their entire mentality. The secretary, Monday, he's very emaciated. It says he's a vegan or vegetarian, and he's eating just half of a raw tomato and a 3/4 of a glass of tepid water. So he's not eating very much. And he says in their dialogue, "Dynamite is not only our best tool, but our best symbol. It is as perfect as a symbol of us as is incense of the prayers of the Christians. It expands. It only destroys because it broadens. Even so, thought only destroys because it broadens. A man's brain is a bomb. A man's brain must expand if it breaks up the universe." And the Marquis, Wednesday, the Jew, the man who's appointed to assassinate the Tsar, he eats very voraciously. He eats a lot, and he eats with a lot of vigor, as does Dr. Bull, another of the younger men, the man with the spectacles. And they both have a very similar mindset. They're men of action. The Marquis says, "I don't want the universe broken up just yet. I want to do a lot of beastly things before I die." And Dr. Bull says, "If the only end of the thing is nothing, it hardly seems worth doing." And Professor de Worms, similarly to the secretary, he's the very old man who's in decay, and he's eating what looks like slops to Syme. And he says, "Every man knows in his heart that nothing is worth doing." So we see that the secretary and Professor de Worms, they have more nihilistic views of things. They just want chaos. They're not men of action. They're rather passive. And on the other hand, the Marquis and Dr. Bull are men of action, and they want violence, and they want to destroy things. And their veracity for eating kind of lines up with their veracity in wanting to do and to create violence. Whereas the secretary and Professor de Worms just want to sit back. The secretary wants to just throw some dynamite and, you know, that's it, from a distance. He doesn't want to get in there with a knife and stab the Tsar. So we'll go through chapter 7 very quickly. It's funny, when the president reveals Gogol, the Pole, Tuesday, as the spy, he immediately drops the foreign accent that he had, and he says, "Righto," in this Cockney British accent. And he reveals his blue card that identifies him as a policeman, the same card that Syme got when he became a policeman. And the president lets Gogol go. He just dismisses him. And the secretary wants to go on talking about the assassination attempt. He thinks, okay, the spy is out of the room, now we can continue on with the discussion, but the president says, "No, we were just talking about this and we were overheard. What makes you think that we may not still be overheard?" And so Syme, of course, gets nervous again because he thinks, oh, maybe he's still on to me. So they all disperse, and Syme is very shaken by everything that's happened, and he's the last one to leave the room. And when he leaves, he goes into a restaurant and eats, and drinks wine. And after that, he feels much better. And it's interesting that he eats with the same voracity as the Marquis and Dr. Bull and Sunday. He eats very heartily and drinks very heartily. And that brings a lot of comfort to him. And it's here that we see, he views the foreigners in this restaurant as kindly aliens instead of the anarchists that he had just encountered. And he starts to realize that Professor de Worms, the old and feeble man, has been following him. And it's a very nightmarish situation. I'm sure we've all had nightmares where someone's chasing after us and, you know, they're always there no matter what we do. Maybe we're running and we don't get anywhere, but we have these nightmares of people chasing us, and that's exactly what happens. And of course, Thyme is astonished because this is a very feeble old man, and he seems to be keeping up with Thyme even as he's darting into alleys and, you know, running as fast as he can to get away from him. Everywhere he stops, he's still there right behind him. And eventually Syme decides to just wait for him, to confront him. Says, as St. George waited for the dragon, maybe waiting for a final explanation or for death. He stops and he waits for him, and the professor comes up to him and just walks right by him. And of course he's utterly confused by that, and the chase continues on for a little bit more until he finally, goes into a tavern and waits there. And of course a few moments later the professor comes in and he orders a glass of milk, like he's been doing at every single stop that they've, gone into. And so we will read chapters 8 and 9 for next week, and we'll see why Professor de Worms has been chasing him all this time. Does anyone have any last comments or questions? Great. Will someone close this in prayer?
Let us pray. Gracious Father, we are grateful. To